Right, the Vechu Elohim Yechoram, one who sacrifices to a idol. This is referring to a strange god, as the Mepharshim point out, shall be destroyed, as Rashi says, you must. Bilti l'Hashem levadam. One may only sacrifice to God alone, to exclude any other being. Even as you know, of course, the Yisra of Avodah Zarah, even if you direct your worship to God, but through an intermediary, that is the essence of Avodah Zarah. Then it says, the ger lo sona, lo sulchatenu. And a ger, you should not oppress or torture. Afflict, actually. Afflict may be a better word. But torture is not the right word. Now here's the interesting part of the pasuk. We've been sort of concentrating on this list. We've had to approach a prophet, right? Do you remember? Last week, you know, we showed how to analyze it. But you saw every prophet has it. And we've broken down into ideas, questions that emerge just in the wording. Gary made you send the earth to triumph, but you are strangers in the land of Mitzrayim. Now, what would you say stands out in that prophet? If you were to analyze the prophet. What is that? When I say analyze, it means you read a prophet, you break it down, and you quite, you know, does it make sense? Does everything fit? Does everything follow? Is there any kind of a problem here? See, that's the question. In other words, but it's interesting how people read this. They just want to show you how you've got to change your mental attitude when you're studying it. The average person reading this would think it's a wonderful idea. Right, that it's a very sublime concept, that since you were strangers, you should not oppress what? Yeah, right. Well, everybody, you know, everybody, even the conservative, not just liberal, everybody basically is describing this, because it sounds good. So you have to understand what people like, the average person, what he likes and dislikes, is usually just the result of how it affects his feelings. It's a chilling kind of a hook. Because people base their society, bases everything, and programs, their lives, and this and that, on certain, because whatever society is doing underneath it, it's because they really think that's the right thing, that's the good. Everybody, whatever a person is doing, he's doing because he believes that this is it, this is the right thing to do, this is the good. No one can escape that. Even a criminal who's breaking laws, whatever he's doing because in his own distorted frame of mind, he believes that is the good. And when you realize what they base that on, it just has things appeal to their emotions. Absolutely no objective foundation for anything they're doing. Now here's something which, on the surface, sounds reasonable. You should not, and sublime. You should not afflict the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. But the question is, on a philosophical level, what kind of a reason is that? I mean, either something is right or it's wrong. It's always based upon objective criteria. So what does it matter? Let's say we would not have been strangers. So this law wouldn't be in the Torah. I mean, that would make any difference? It would be okay to afflict a stranger? So if the reason is because it's wrong, one should not take advantage of someone who is in a weak position. That's basically the whole thing. Because if you take a look at the next part, it's going to say, Kol Almana V'yasam Lo Ta'anon. It ties it in together with an Almana. Almana is a widow and an orphan, you should not humiliate or humble, oppress. So therefore, the Torah is talking about the human tendency to take advantage of the weak.
Is it also part of the thing that there should be extra mitzvah?
Yes, yes. On the contrary, the special mitzvah, of course, of chesed. Definitely, definitely. There's a greater, obviously, if you do a favor for anybody, by the way, it's a favor. Even for a wealthy person and a secure person and has everything he needs, but you do him a chesed, it's still a chesed. But if you do a chesed for the needy, it's a greater chesed. There's no question about it. I mean, objectively speaking, you can't compare someone to the person who's desperately in need. So it's a greater good. But, on the other hand, even if you do a chesed for a wealthy person, it's still a chesed. But here the Torah is talking about the concept of oppression, and there is something unique, because really, you could even ask a different question. I mean, why does the Torah have to point out that you shouldn't depress the widow or the orphan, or what about the ordinary person? You shouldn't depress them either. Right? So that's another question. There's two questions over here now. First of all, why, as Shalom pointed out, is the reason has to be given that we were slaves in the land of Egypt. That shouldn't be germane. It shouldn't be the essential point. The essential point is because the Romans were oppressed. And secondly, why is the Torah pointing out that we shouldn't oppress the weak? We shouldn't oppress the strong either. What's the difference? I mean, the person is not an orphan, so you're allowed to oppress them. What's the difference over here? Those are the questions. As we say, because we have to learn from Alpha, you should love your friend, and friend really means any fellow Jew like yourself. So all Jews are equal in that respect, in terms of the treatment that they are entitled to from another Jew. They're all equal in that respect. Take a look at Rashi. The Ramban is more in line with what Mike is saying, that the Torah pointed out because there is a greater tendency, a greater emotional temptation to oppress the weak, the gayer, and there's a certain common denominator in these cases. That's the Ramban. The Rashi gives a strange reason. Well, he says like this, "Ki gayer miyitem, for you are strangers. Im ho nito, if you insult him, achu yachol lahon nitzchur, he too can insult you, he can afflict you. Velomar lo, can say to you, af atem migerem basa. You too come from gerem. Mum shevacha, al tomar lachavercha. Your own mum, you shouldn't mention to your friend." What does it mean? In other words, what Rashi is saying is, when you insult a person, be careful not to insult him with something which can be turned hurled right back at you. Alright? In other words, if you're going to make fun out of somebody else's parents, let us say. So, whatever the case might be, whatever the issue might be, so let's say you have the same thing in your family, your parents, whatever it is. That's not good policy. If you're going to make fun out of a person's look. If you're not that good looking yourself, so that's not the kind of thing you should... If you're going to make fun out of whatever it is, right? Yeah. So that's what Rashi said, on the surface, Mum Shevcha. Your own blemish, do not mention to somebody else. Don't criticize somebody else for something which you yourself are very vulnerable to. You have the same problem yourself. That's what Rashi says. Now, what's difficult? Does Rashi solve our problem, or does Rashi increase our difficulty?
Yeah. He doesn't help the problem
of God. Yeah. Seems like
you know,
the people. Well,
what is he talking about? You're
going to
install
a
person.
Now, he's saying, therefore, since you were strangers, do not oppress the stranger, because he could turn right around to you and say, you also come from strangers.
This is the same problem
as
before. Right. Before, we had the problem of the person, and because we did it. Then we should do it. Because we can do it, we can do it. We do the same thing. The reason we shouldn't insult them is because they cannot help us.
Yeah. I would say that if anything, Rashi increases it. Because, Shalom, what's Rashi giving us? Practical advice? And as Rashi, what Rashi's saying is, when you insult someone, it's important to remember, insult them in something that you're not vulnerable to. So what is the point? To teach us how to insult people? We're not supposed to insult people. At all. What is it? Rashi giving us practical advice. We'll write a little guidebook on how to rank a person out. When you rank a person out, make sure before you do so that he can't hurl it back at you. Right? I mean, if you read, Rashi doesn't mean this, but superficially, that's what it seems to be saying. In other words, it's okay to insult a person, but just make sure that you're smart about it. It's not something, don't accuse another person of stealing, if you were in jail for 3 years for the same thing, because we'll just turn it back at you. But that can't be what Rashi means. So we'll see if we can get a a deeper understanding. What's Rashi trying to point out? You know, according to Rashi, Tigerim HaYitam is a warning to you that you can, if you do it to him, he can do it to you. But what's he telling us? All right, fine, thank you very much. But that's the reason? Yeah. It says in Perek Yigimel Shmuel Beis, right, that Avshalom, the son of David, had a beautiful sister. Her name was Tamar. And Amnon, the son of David, loved her. And Amnon became like ill. He started to become sick with love. A tremendous, I'm sure everybody can identify with that type of feeling. Tremendous the feeling of emptiness, and it's the point where a person gets sick. Because of his sister Tamar, it says, for she was a virgin. Then it says, but he probably didn't know Amnon, and it was just the answer. But he probably means like it was wondrous in his eyes, lost of love and umma, to do anything to her. In other words, he couldn't even approach her. He was like smitten with love. Then it says, he has a friend. He always got to look after your friend, who was a wise man. And then he said to him, what are you so sick about? Every day, you know, tell me. And he told him what it was. So now, this Yonadav gave him advice. He cooked up a little scheme over here. Basic idea of the scheme was that he should get into bed and act as though he's ill. Act as though he's ill. And then the king would come to visit him, you know, David. And then when he would ask him what he wanted, he would tell that he wanted Tamar, his sister, to come and cook up certain cakes or whatever it was that he liked. That would make him feel better. You know, seemingly innocent type of a request. And so David went along with it. David had no idea what was going on. And Tamar came. She had no idea what was going on. And the point of it was that when she came into the room, and because the thing, he got everybody else to leave, and then he'd be alone with her, So, what happened was that's exactly what occurred, and he was alone with her, and he took her, and she resisted. You know, she was a righteous woman. And she pleaded with him not to do it, and she said that this would be a tremendous disgrace and humiliation, but that if you speak to the king, I'm certain that he would give you permission to marry me, to David. You know, what do you have to do this for? But nevertheless, he was totally out of control. He was totally irrational, and he did not listen to her, and he seized her, and he raped her. He raped her. All right, but the point is, now, up that one back to this, so that's not what I really want to concentrate on. What's interesting is, as soon as he had his way with her, so to speak, so the prophet says, by Yisrael Amnon Sinigadol Ma'od, he hated her a tremendous hatred. And bear in mind that he was so in love with her that he was actually lovesick. And after he did this action, he hated her tremendously. And it was the hatred that he hated her was greater than the love that he had loved her. So then, right after the act, he says, get up and leave. Kick her out. Then she said, what you're doing to me now, to throw her out in that state, is worse than the first humiliation that you did to me. But in other words, he just wanted her to just get out. Rather than having a chance to compose herself, whatever it is, he just kicked her out, treated her like a piece of dirt. So she pleaded with him and said, do not do this to me. This is even more humiliating than the first humiliation. And then he called his assistant, his Mashari, and said, Rosie, get this one out of here. And close the door after her. So, of course, many things happened as a result of he lost his life because she left in a state of depression and mourning, and her brother Avshalom found out, and eventually Avshalom killed Amnon. And yes, you know, the whole triggered off tremendous events. But let's try and understand this on a psychological level. What happened?
Very simple.
How did the love turn into hatred? Why did he suddenly hate her? It doesn't make any sense. He had this tremendous love for her, and he cooked up the scheme, and he took it by force. He did the wrong thing, but he did. So, you can understand different types of responses, but why would he have this particular response of tremendous hatred? Greater was the hatred that he felt for the love. Oh, the day brings up. Let's say the child is nagging the parents for the ice cream, and whatever it is, and finally they give him the ice cream. So either he likes it or doesn't like it. If he doesn't like it, I mean, why is he going to start hating the parents because of that? Or is that a good analogy? I don't know if that's a proper analogy. David? Exactly. In other words, you know, very often happens. So it's hard to explain this to people when they're in a state of love. And it's not just love for a woman. But everybody that's pursuing their dream in life is in the same state. The person's pursuing a dream of success or becoming wealthy, whatever it is. The person has a certain fantasy. Now the fantasy tells them, the reason why a person gets so upset and so desperate, and the reason why people get into all kinds of schemes, murders, this thing, crimes and everything. Why do they do all these things? Because they were so desperate, they felt that they weren't going to achieve that which they needed the most. I mean, you see today, prominent people, apparently, business or civic politicians, right? And they dig into these crazy schemes, and then they get caught. Why'd they do it? Because this guy became tremendously in debt, and he had this thing, he was going to lose his whole reputation, he was going to lose his girlfriend, he was going to lose this. Now, in his own mind, he believes that if he doesn't have this, he can't, that's part of his life, that's the essence of his life. Now, what happens to a person when he's pursuing something which is really a fantasy, and most people are just pursuing fantasies, when they actually achieve it, it'd be the worst possible thing to know. You see, the most miserable people in the world are those who have achieved their fantasies, not the ones who haven't. You take a look at all the Hollywood stars, these people, after achieving success, they can simply go crazy. They totally go crazy, Elvis Presley and others, they go on drugs and they can't survive. Because it's not what they thought it was. They were pursuing something. It's very interesting. The world revolves. If you want a clear depiction of what keeps the world going, it's like a doggy race. So all the doggies are chasing the rabbit. Right? They don't know that it's just an illusion. They're never going to get the rabbit. And if they ever did get the rabbit, it certainly wouldn't be what they needed to be. Am I right? Uh-huh. But the world is doing the same thing. The whole world is a big doggy race chasing some rabbit out there, which they're never going to catch. I like that. It's a good formulation of the world. It's basically what it is. The world is just a doggy race. Everybody's chasing the rabbit, which they're never going to get. And the unhappy ones, the sociologists have said it. The two classes that are most unhappy are the ones that have caught the rabbit, so they have nothing to run. They're not happy with the rabbit, and they have nothing to run for. And the ones that can't get into the race, like that's the really low, But the the people who are the least happy are the ones that are in the race. Because at least they're racing, and they're to the extent that they're chasing it, right? So they have the fantasy. They think they're going to, it's not so bad, they're moving at least. They're not really totally happy. But they're not, it's a great pain. Because they believe that they're going to get the rabbit. They have a chance. But of course, we know that if they, the worst thing that could happen would be that if they actually got the rabbit. Because then they're going to be totally disappointed. What happens to a person when he achieves his dream is disillusionment sets in. Tremendous disillusionment. And that's why a lot of artists and writers, if you read about them, you see that they'll always tell you the happiest times in their life was when they were struggling. It's interesting. Even I remember seeing an interview with Menachem Begin, because Begin was in the underground for many years and then in the political opposition for years and years. He was finally elected in 1977. He became prime minister. His whole life he was an outcast, an outsider. So when he was, now he got the cover that he was looking, he wanted to be honored, to be respected, to be the great statesman. So he was doing an interview on TV and they asked him what was the happiest time in his life. So what would you imagine? It should be, this is the happiest time of my life, because I've been struggling all my life for this. He says the happiest days were when they were in the underground, when they were fighting for peace. That was the happiest days of his life. His life was full of meaning and everything, and he's involved in the struggle. You understand? But that's philosophically, there's something wrong with that. It's an absurdity. Because you can't tell me that being in that state is the ultimate, right? Because if that's the case, then you should never achieve freedom. The best thing is to be in a state when you don't have it, so you can struggle for it. But that's crazy, because the only value of struggling for it is to obtain it. So the struggle is a means to an end, but the end should be greater than the means, right? Does it make sense? Isn't it philosophically, it's absurd. I struggled all my life to achieve this, right? Which means to say that what I'm struggling for is greater than what I'm in right now, than the struggle. You can't say the struggle is greater than the thing it's intended to achieve. That doesn't make any sense. It's like a person is struggling and struggling all year to go on a vacation. And then in retrospect, I enjoyed the struggle more than the vacation. I mean, it's crazy. Nobody would accept that type of a thing. But you see that apparently, in his own mind, when he was struggling, he certainly imagined that the goal is greater than the struggle. But when he actually achieved the goal, it's not the same. A certain sense of disappointment. Many people, successful writers or artists, after they've created their masterpiece, very often they go into a tremendous depression. Well, Howard Hughes, for example. Howard Hughes, when he was younger, when he was struggling and working, he was productive, he was inventive, he was alive. Then, later on, he went completely into a total depression. And I mean, crazy, insane. I mean, he lived in some insanity. He was due from reality. Now, if most people would think to have what he had, all the success and all the wealth, in those days, I guess he was just about the wealthiest guy, would be, that's what they would love. But they don't realize how ignorant they are of their own nature. The reason why people imagine this is because very few people have any kind of an insight into their own nature on a deeper level. They look at things very superficially. They look at things very superficially. So they focus on the immediate need. A person has an immediate need, and he focuses his whole life on that one immediate need. A person is hungry, all he needs is, like a Yom Kippur. And Yom Kippur, all other problems seem to melt away. If I could just have a good meal, right? And when a person is struggling for money, right, they think if they just had money, or when they meet a girl, if I just had this, and they imagine in their own mind that this thing, they begin to overestimate and forget, and they make it much, much bigger than it is. That's a fantasy, but most people live out, And then what they do is, instead of learning the lesson, when they get tired of one fantasy, they now, oh, that isn't the thing. I'll now being a big success is the thing. I'll be a great doctor or something. Like, that's the thing. I'm making a lot of money and I'll be respected. That's the thing. And the point of it all is that it all has one thing in common. It's just a fantasy. And people have no idea of their own nature. So when they achieve the thing that they were searching for, of course, there's an initial sense of elation. But that is followed by the reality that they're not really happy. It doesn't satisfy their needs. And they're worse off than they were before. Because before they were able to say the reason that they're unhappy is because they don't have that thing. Now they've got that thing and they're still unhappy, so they become totally disillusioned, and that's what leads very often to suicide. Because now a person can say to himself that life itself is worthless. Because what's the whole purpose of living? I thought it was to achieve such and such. Now I've achieved such and such, and I'm just as miserable as I was before. So now there's nothing more to do. Life, that they're telling us life. All right?
I think that's not
how it's
going to be at all.
I'm sorry?
I think
that's
not
how
it's going to
be at all. Yeah, right. First intent to suicide, well, there could be other factors, but I'm not saying there's only one cause of suicide. But in this case, when it stems from this general unhappiness, a total sense of disillusionment, they cannot focus on any other chances. In other words, they're disillusioned to the extent that they see a fantasy. When a person gets caught up in a fantasy, he's got to lend a certain reality to it. You can't hook a person on a fantasy. A good salesman knows how to hook a person on a fantasy that's, realistic to him. If I'm going to stand there and tell you a suit of clothes, this and that, and try. The fantasy, it's got to be something that's believable. You're going to be, if it's too far away from reality, no one's going to buy it. the value of the fantasy. You see, when people fantasize about things, they don't fantasize. They fantasize about things that are, you know, sort of, in one sense, maybe unobtainable, but not totally unobtainable. Not totally unrealistic. There is some reality. There is some possibility. That's why you always have the story of a guy who did go to California, who did meet the star, who did. I mean, there's some... In other words, if I was to give you a fantasy where there's no identity, you can't identify with it, it's too far removed from reality, you couldn't enjoy it. But the enjoyment is the sense that it really could. There is a possibility. You have to be able to lend reality to it. So a person cannot get back into a fantasy. When a person commits suicide, it means that he's become a cynic. He knows it's not going to happen. He knows it's a fantasy, and it's pointless to get involved in another project because it's ridiculous. It's just going to lead to the same result. So why bother? So why bother? Then the person, all the first bit of man, a person has psychological energy, has to go somewhere. When a person, see, depression comes when a person can't, has no outlet for all the psychic energy. It's running most. A person needs outlet. He needs activity. He needs to discharge his psychic energy. It's not enough. I mean, a person doesn't live just by bread, which means, what do you mean a person doesn't live just by bread? What does it mean? I mean, well, of course, what's the Kiddush of the Torah? A person can't survive, a person can't live a human existence if you just satisfy the physical needs. You take an individual and just, see, you take an animal, basically, and just satisfy basic physical needs, so it's fine. That's why even in a zoo, which is not the greatest, because animals like to roam a little bit, but just give them their food, water, whatever, and they survive. But a human is different. You take a human being and give him his basic physical needs, he is not going to survive. He's going to be miserable and depressed. We need, that's why people invent all kinds of things. Of course, we know how nonsensical they are. They have to watch TV, they play a game, they get involved in basketball, maybe sports, and there are stupid, idiotic, meaningless, senseless, nonsensical things imaginable. They play Scrabble, but they play cards, they go to the group, they have their little clubs, they have their little parties, they make their little fundraisers. Why do they do all this? Because man doesn't live by bread alone. The fact that people are involved in these things just goes to show you that they need projects. Why are people getting these things of needing 44 dogs and making Yeah, they need something. Now, the thing is like this. But a person can't be satisfied, I told you, a person can't be satisfied with a meaningless activity. That's why we learn by inevitably. Remember we said that, It says, Losavdu bo b'farach, that inevitably, the Jewish servant, or slave, if you want to use that term, a servant is a better term, you're not allowed to work them with oppressive labor. I gave the share on that recently. Oppressive labor, as I pointed out at the time, is not necessarily, because it's physically painful, but meaningless labor. To make work, in other words. To make him do jobs. Why? Because that's a blow to his dignity. It's a blow to his dignity. So in doing this, see, when people get involved in nonsensical activities, as you said, doing all these things for animals and making sweaters for them, it's only because they need an outlet for their energy, but the outlet can't be something which is totally meaningless, so therefore, in their own minds, they have to create a meaning for it. And that's exactly how sports. So people get involved in sports. And sports is basically a meaningless, senseless activity. Right? Mm-hmm. Totally meaningless. So, because what difference does it make? I don't care. The fact that it involves skill, as I pointed out to you, is not the essence, because there are many activities that are much more skillful. You can watch a great tailor or a great craftsman doing crafts. It can be much more skillful, but people aren't going to sit around and watch it. They're not interested. So, yeah. So therefore, they create this activity, which is a totally senseless thing. Well, let's look at it realistically. You have a hoop. You have a round object, and the objective is to get this thing, and you have five guys on one side, and five guys trying to stop them from doing it, according to fixed rules, how they can progress and how they can stop them, right? And they work at all kinds of strategies to get, within the framework of the rules, to get through the defense. And get the ball. What is the whole purpose of all this that the ball wants to do? I mean, there's nothing more meaningless. Who cares? How can anybody care? How can anybody consider this to be important? And yet, every night on television, the announcements are made, this team beat this team and that team. To just tell a person that he shouldn't have put the gear. So there are many. There are many similar types of ideas that people subscribe to. Everybody recognizes that it's wrong to do this, it's wrong to take advantage, but people do it anyway. You sort of realize that in order to really prevent it, it's not enough just to withdraw the person or to warn a person, but to give a person an insight into what causes them to do it. And the insight in this case is the tendency toward projection. In other words, a person oppresses others because he cannot face up to defects in his own personality. And the Torah illustrates it in the instance of the ger, because there's a natural desire to feel superior. That's why you see people look down on a ger, a stranger. People always look down on a stranger. And if a person comes to this country, he's sort of second class. You feel superior. This is your country. A person feels a natural sense of superiority that it's his country. So that's an absurd thing. And also, if a person can't speak well, they make fun out of him. Why do they make fun of a person who doesn't speak the language well? They like people like to make fun out of that. It's really absurd. If you were to say it's not that you're superior. First of all, what's funny about it? It's a natural phenomenon. A person comes from one language, starts to learn another language, so of course he's going to have problems. He's never going to speak as well as someone who was born there. It's virtually impossible. So what's so funny about that? The answer is, it gives you a certain feeling of superiority. Like, I was a stupid thing, like, you could speak better than this guy, so what? The answer, however, is that that people need, there's a tremendous need in people to have other people that they can put down. Because it enables them to cope with certain defects of their own. And that's why it's the greatest enjoyment to make fun out of somebody else, to read about somebody else's problems or scandals. That's why the newspaper says there are nothing but personalizing scandals, whether it be Donald Trump, it's not, and it's highly questionable whether it's legitimate even to print all that. It's American law. I mean, they have that crazy concept as to what is privacy and what's not. But it's nothing but lush and hurry, really. And so people love that. Why do people love it so much? Why do people love it? Because they all have their own inadequacies and deficiencies, and they can't face them. So the way to discharge of that is to put down other people. And that's what Rashi is saying. It's just mumsha b'chor. He doesn't mean, what Rashi is saying is, he could turn around and say the same thing to you. Not giving you practical advice. You realize in your own mind that you're no different than he is. And if you realize that, then you'll realize what you're trying to do. By oppressing him, you're trying to deny a certain perceived defect within yourself. And that's the reason why you shouldn't be oppressed. As Mike points out, that meaningless activities, if a person who does meaningless activities is really a blow to the person, even though we say the person has the need for outlet. As he points out, I know this fact myself, but Mike points out in the concentration camps, to break the spirit of the Jews, they used to make them do meaningless activities. Not that they needed things, they had enough there to break their spirit, but as an added thing, they would have them just digging up ditches and then filling it up with earth again and digging it up and then earth again. Paro did the same thing. I mentioned, but I think I mentioned it. Did I mention it by Paro? Yeah, it says by Paro too. But they broke the spirit of the Jews. It wasn't just the labor, because they realized that if a person is doing the labor, but you see, it's interesting. I don't know how many people are familiar. There was a movie, The Bridge Over the Kwai. Did you see that movie? I don't recommend, it's not I know that you do watch movies occasionally. This one is, and the book, I read the book. The book is fantastic. It's a short book, beautifully written. It's a very interesting psychological study. So, it's one of the, if you're going to see a movie, that's one which really has a point. It's a very brilliantly done movie. It was a great movie. The Bridge Over the River Kwai. You can rent it, I guess. And I'll just give you the story. The basic story is about this group, of English soldiers that were captured by the Japanese. And they had their commander with them, and he tried to maintain discipline. And according to the laws of war and so on and so forth, so the Japs had them building a bridge. The Bridge Over the River Kwai. And he saw, and then he had a project. So that's what kept his men from falling apart. But they were forced to build a bridge for the Japanese. And this gave him a good tremendous insight into the whole psyche of a military commander. So this gave him the project, and he had his men disciplined and so on, and they got completely caught up in the project of building the bridge. And then what happens is that the Allies were seeking to blow up that bridge. And they got word, I think, I don't remember all the particulars of the story, but the whole drama is that here they are planning to blow up this bridge, and he's completed the bridge, and he's very proud of the bridge. So in other words, his whole involvement in the creation of the bridge becomes totally separated from his concept of the war. This is for the enemy. And if you want, you'll see what how it works out. So it's brilliantly done. But the point is, it shows the other side of the picture. That, you see, that if a person is involved in labor, that was a laborious activity, that itself will not crush him, because he can attach a certain sense of pride and accomplishment to it. You see? So if they have, like Pharaoh or the Germans, if they had the Jews doing tremendous labor, so that, in one sense, it's crushing. And the other thing, though, a person can feel a certain sense of accomplishment in that. It's interesting. It's interesting. This could be the idea. I never thought of it. But it mentions in Shemot, at the beginning of Shemot, it mentions that the Egyptians, so they may have learned this lesson. It's a nice idea. I never thought of this before.
Pharaoh took the man and he gave him a job in for...
It says, one second, by a symbol of... So they appointed over them officers, to impose a tax in order to humble them with their heavy labor. By even and they built storage cities or fortified cities for Pharaoh, as Pisombe of Ramses. The Chashay animals, and as they afflict them, came here with Chenifros. They multiplied and they spread out. So this failed. By the Kutu of Israel. And so on and so forth. But you see that, well, why did it fail? It could be that it is true that they were doing any kind of physical labor, but they built cities. So they got involved in the project of building the city, and the fact that you accomplished something. I mean, look, a guy could be out there working, a guy could be this guy 6 o'clock in the morning and coming home 10 o'clock at night, working constantly, right? Exhaustion, physical. He can be in a state of euphoria because he's building and he's succeeding and in his own framework he's very happy. So it's not the labor per se which destroys a person. So the Nazis understood this, and the nature of the task was meaningless. That destroys a person, because then he's exhausting himself physically, and there's nothing he can attach it to as an objective. But that other case also, the
The question is, what is considered to be temporary? When we say that a Navi can uproot a law of the Torah temporarily, the Rambam uses the term l'fisha, for a time. It would seem that it's not like a fixed amount of years. That would be unusual, it wouldn't make sense. Temporary means it relates to a certain situation. Because they give the example of Eliyahu Bahar Carmel. He quotes Chazal and say, "Bakol miyom lacha navi, whatever the navi tells you to do, avor al divrei Torah. If he tells you to violate divrei Torah, ke Eliyahu b'har Karmel, like Eliyahu in Har Karmel, Shemara listened to him, Chutz Me'achim, except if he studied Torah Shabbakim. Rusha Yi HaDevil Fi Shah. But that's only if the issue is a temporary one, like Elio Bahar Karmel. What did he do? He was Makriv and Ola B'chutz. What he did was, he gathered all the people at Bahar Karmel and slaughtered sacrifices, and it would be Yavau, to contradict the false prophet. So Lefisha, according to this, that would be the model of Lefisha. Therefore, he wasn't doing Avodah Zarah. He was being mocked to God, and he told them to worship the Baal. And then God would cause the fire to come down and consume his whoever sacrifices would be consumed by fire. That would be a demonstration. But what he was doing was sacrificing to God. They were sacrificing to Baal. Now, what he was the issue he was doing was not an issue of Avodah Zarah. It was rather an issue of being mocked outside of Yerushalayim. But he was given a heter to do it, Lefi Shah. So Lefi Shah seems to be that it relates to a particular situation. You can't say that 500 years. There's no such thing. That's different. But Lefi Shah would have to be because of the known. It would have to relate to a passing situation. That's Lefi Shah. Alright? He concludes it, but he says, V'im Amru Shazav and Nekar, the Olam, he says, that the matter has been uprooted permanently, misasa b'chenek. Then he is killed with choking. Shatara omra, because the Torah said, lanu ulkanenu adolam. Which means that the Torah is permanent. Lanu ulkanenu adolam. That the Torah is not meant for abrogation. The Torah cannot be abrogated. Nor can any part of the Torah be abrogated. Because the Torah is the work of God, and it's perfect. Then he said, look at this. Now we go first, Allah HaDalad. The Chayin and Makar Dava Mitzvaram Shalamadinu Mitiha Shnua. And so too, if we uproot anything which we learn from the Shnua. What does it mean, what does the Ram mean by Shnua? Mitiha Shnua? From the Tosh Bal Peh. From the oral interpretation. That was handed down from generation to generation. Osha Amar B'din Midine Torah. Or if he said, and this is an interesting one, if he said concerning any of the laws of the Torah, Shashem Tivalo, Shatin Kahu, the Allah Gidabe Plani, he says that God commanded him, but the din is like this, or that the Allah is according to this one's view, Harez a Navi Sheker, V'yechane. This person is a Navi Sheker and he is choked, dies by choking. Achal Pisha Osa Os, even if he did a sign. Sharezol Lahakesh HaTorah, because he has come to contradict the Torah, Sharamra, which said, Lo Bashamayim Hi, it is not in heaven. Avol Lafisha, but if it is temporary, Shoman Lo Bakol, we listen to him concerning everything. Now, what's strange about this Rambam, yes? He has two things over here. First of all, he says that if he's mocked at something which we learn on Torah Shabbat Peh. So it's not necessarily only something which is in the Torah Shabbat Chav. But let's say it's an interpretation. For example, if he comes to be mocked as Tvillin, the mitzvah of Tvillin, so that we've learned already, that's a Navi Shekhar. But let's say he accepts Tvillin, but he says that instead of this parsha, it should be a different parsha. Or now we have it already on the Torah Shabbat, what parshios are to be inserted in the Torah. Or he says instead of four parshios, there's five parshios. He makes a change. He makes a change in the Torah Shabbat. Permanently. Or he. So that's what the Rambam is adding over here. That you might think that he's only an Avi Sheker if he's makrish something in the one of the mitzvot per se. But if he contradicts something which we have accepted on the basis of the Torah Shabbat Peh, so then that does not render, he's not chayav nisa for that. And I'm not saying it doesn't make any difference. Any way in which he distorts Torah, whether it be through the Torah Shabbat Peh, or whether it be through the Torah Shabbat Peh, that renders him into a Navi Sheker. Then he adds another thing. Now, doesn't seem like anybody noticed it. He says, Osha Amar B'din, what does that mean when he says, Osha Amar B'din Midine Torah? Shashem Sibolo, Shadin Kach, Behuva Allah Sibolo. What's he doing over there? In other words, let's say there's a machlokas between the scholars. And another, we don't know. Both of them are experts in the field, and we don't really know who is correct. And the Navi comes with the Nebuah, and he says that the halacha is that God told him that he shouldn't form everybody, that this is the halacha. And the halacha is in accordance with an accepted view. So there, what's he being makash? Where's the akasha? He's operating with the system, right? For example, there's a machlokas, you know, about Rashi's filling, about Tom's filling, on the order of the parasha. Let's say the Navi would come and provide credentials and notes, etc., and say that God told him that the Rashi is correct, or the other way of wording, or Ben Thomas is correct, in any issue. Now, the Ram has told us that that person would also be executed. Now, why? Where's the Akasha? Where's the denial? Mashiach is not. Mashiach personally will be a Navi, but he will not exercise Nevuah in his mission. There's a key difference. As we've already learned, that God can bestow Nevuah for personal perfection of the Gavra, or for the sake of the Tzibur, that God wants to communicate a message to the Tzibur. But in the case of Mashiach, he will not be established in Nevuah. He'll be established through so clear. There is no predetermined Mashiach. According to Rabbi Chaim Shach, there is no people, so to speak. It's not. It's totally against the accepted view of the Jewish people that there is a predetermined person who is Mashiach, and we don't know, and he could come at any minute, and he's the Mashiach. That's it. It's not the case. But rather. It's an individual who has certain abilities, perfects himself, and exercises his bechira and succeeds in performing the task. So therefore, it could be one of a number of people. You see, the Mashiach, and they finally got it wrong. He wasn't. He failed. Had he not failed, he might have been a Mashiach. Had he not failed. Okay, we have something else. What the Rambam over here is saying is that if the Navi says that God told him what the halacha is, then he tries Nisa. Why? What did he do wrong over here? At the time of the machlokas develops, there are plenty of machlokas, and in fact, new issues arise, and a person comes with the proof that he's a Navi and so forth, and says that God told him that this is the right way. We're not sure about electricity, if it doesn't run on this, or whatever. There are many, many questions today. And Rabbi comes and he says that God told him that this is the halacha. The Rambam would say he has to be executed. What did he do wrong? He's following the halacha system, and he could show you the reasons. Let's put it this way. Let's say he not only tells us this, but he shows us clear, convincing arguments that the disputants would agree he's right. They would both agree that he's right. He'd be executed. That's what the Rambam is telling us in the Torah. What's the reason for it? Because he is being mocked, he's contradicting the Torah. Where is he contradicting the Torah? Because the Torah is called Lo Bashamayim. What does it mean, Lo Bashamayim? It is not in heaven. Lo Bashamayim means that you can't use heavenly method, any type of divine. Support for a halakhic decision. That is to say that too is part of the system. That too is part of the system. How to resolve issues. But God gave the Torah, Lo Bashamayim means that God gave the Torah over to man, not to mankind per se, but to the Baalei HaMasorah, to the select group who determine, who are the experts and who determine. And they make the determinations according to the rules which God has given them. And that is the Torah. That's why it says that the Hashofet, you should go to the Shofet, that you only have the Shofet who's in your time. Now, therefore, a person cannot count. Let's say, for example, there's a machlokas between two, like we have today, different schools of thought, different rabbis.
and some fellow from their yeshiva will come over. Let's make a juicy. Whoever the case might be. Let's say the fellows from that other yeshiva, whatever case it would be, would come and say, of course, they are their viewers left because they have heavenly signs. There are voices coming from heaven, or other phenomena which clearly show, miraculously to demonstrate, that their position is correct. So would we now be obliged to follow their position?
No.
The answer is no, because we operate solely according to the laws of halachic determination. And that's it. That's how God wants us. Right, right. God wants us to operate within that framework. Therefore, it is not a function of the Nabi to fast and shadow. Because if he were to do so, he'd be upholding the very system that God has given him. That is to say, again, as long as it's not Lafisha. If he says so Lafisha, then that he wouldn't be up to this. In other words, if we came and said that God wants to use such and such Lafisha, according to one view or another view, that's Lafisha, that's temporary. And temporary is not considered obligation. Alright? However, if he comes and says that's what God told him to do, to fast in a shadow this way or that way, so then we know that he's a false prophet. Because the Torah was given over to the hands of the scholars, and operating according to the system is a system. And he can't uproot the system. Right, let me just finish this up, Eric. When is it said, Bishar Mitzvah? By other Mitzvah. This is a very important halacha. However, when it comes to Avodah Zarah, we do not listen to him, even Lafi Shah, even temporarily. And even if he performs, again, he keeps mentioning in all these cases, Jeremy, that's why he has to keep repeating himself on this. Apparently the Rambam felt it was necessary. Because people are very, I don't know if there's a Havim in there, logically, but sometimes the Rama might repeat something. He addresses himself to people, you see, and he knows how people are influenced. You see, the Rama keeps repeating many times, our belief is not founded upon ourselves and Muslims. He keeps repeating that because people, just the opposite, people are looking for ourselves and Muslims, and people who don't have true knowledge tend to base their beliefs. They're very much influenced by wonders, by signs and wonders, by miracles. So he says, even if he's performed great miracles here, he's become great ones. V'yomar Shashem Tivo Shetavo Akam Hayom Uvad. Here, even with Ishaq, he even says that God commanded him that they should worship Akam just today. In other words, just for one day. So it's with Ishaq. It's not a permanent abrogation. Obishaq Zub Uvad, or this particular hour. Harezah Zibar Sar Al Hashem. This person has spoken rebelliously about God. The Alzet Sivar Kasa Yama, and concerning this to the public commander, and say, Uvo Ozi Amalfes, and even if the sign and the wonder does come about, Lo Sishmael Diva Nevi Hu, you should not listen to the words of this Nevi, Ki Zivar Sar Al Hashem Lokechem, for he has spoken rebelliously against the Lord your God. Sharefa Allah Hakkesh Nivuasa Shal Moshe, because he has come to contradict the Nevuah of Moshe. For the Pichach Neza Bavada is from Navi Sheka. Thus we know for sure that he's a Navi Sheka. The Chol Masha Asa and everything that he's done, but Lot the Kishif Asa has been performed with magic or wizardry. The Echanek in his execute. Now the question is, why? If we said that what makes him into a Navi Sheka is the fact that he is teaching us something which abrogates the Torah of Moshe. And the Torah of Moshe is something which we know by direct knowledge. Not through miracles, but through direct knowledge. So therefore, we know that and the only reason we listen to the Navi is because the Navi, we've been commanded to listen to the Navi in the Torah of Moshe. Okay. So therefore, by definition, anything which contradicts the Navi of Moshe is automatically false. But we've already established that if it's Lafi Shah, it's not an abrogation. If it's supposed to be sure, it's not an obligation. So why is it that by a Zara, he's hired Nisa? Of course, if he tells us that God is now permitted a Avodah Zara, that's like anything else. That's like anything else. That's an abrogation. But if he said that we could do a Avodah Zara Lepisha, and Lepisha is not an abrogation, so then why is that being mocked in the Rosh Hashanah? Where do we see it that it's being mocked in the Rosh Hashanah Moshe Rabbeinu? I believe he's right. In other words, because the Rambam says in many different places that the Kalat HaRakua, a person who admits, who acknowledges idolatry, is denying the entire Torah. Denies the entire Torah. And he says, conversely, one who denies idolatry is confirming the entire Torah. Because the essence of the entire Torah is Yedias Hashem. To have a true concept of man's relationship to God. That's the essence, that's the purpose of every mitzvah in the Torah. And therefore, it's not, see, with Avodah Zarah, it's different. Every other mitzvah is a means to an end, has a specific purpose, right? But one can't say that temporarily, it's part of the system. You can't change the system. But you can't say that temporarily it's a denial, it's a negation of the entire Torah. In a different context, the Rambam says, for example, he gives the analogy that a doctor, the idea of a Rosh Hashanah, what's the concept behind? The concept behind the Rosh Hashanah is that it fits within the framework of the system. The idea that there can be temporary hiccups, the things that are normally offered, he gives this analogy because it's part of the system. Within, sometimes to save the system, you have to sacrifice a part of the system temporarily to save the system. As a doctor, he says, well, sometimes they move the liver of the patient in order to save the patient, but that can only be said about certain things. You can't remove the heart to save the patient. That's the structure to say. So the whole system is a system which is intended to take a person out of idolatry and into the true idea. Now, you can't use idolatry to cure idolatry. That's a contradiction there. So, in other words, to say that God is mafia or idolatry is to deny the Torah. Even temporarily. That's a denial of the Torah. And therefore, it's machtesh of Rosh Hashanah. So anything else depends. If he wants to abrogate something permanently, then he's changing the character of the Torah. But if he wants to abrogate it temporarily, so we understand that the system itself does require that some of its parts may sometimes be suspended. That suspension, then any system will have to have that. Because no system can be that perfect that one can say that in every situation, everything's becoming, sometimes you have to. You have to make these concessions, because it's impossible to have a system like that. But there will never be situations that will never come about. People have free will. These people have free will, so situations can develop where it becomes necessary for the salvation of the system to suspend something. But that's a temporary suspension. You're not changing the character of the system. That you can't do. Because that situation will not persist. But Avodah Zarah can never be permitted. Because that's not suspended. There's no system anymore. Avodah Zarah can hardly have shut down of the system. So you can never, the Torah itself can never permit Avodah Zarah. Because when you permit Avodah Zarah, you're just destroying the whole system of Torah. Impossible. Alright, that's basically the judge. The analogy is that the Avodah Zarah would be like taking away the heart. System, I don't mean to excuse me, I want to make it very clear. The system of God is perfect. It's the most perfect system. But the Rambam speaks about the Mora, that any system which is intended for a group, for humanity, has to be worked out in a way that it's not too rigid, that it's not too loose, and so on and so forth. Now, in order for the system to survive, it's going to be a different, so you're dealing, in other words, you're dealing with people's free will. So the people have the capacity to corrupt the system and situations arise. So therefore, the system itself has to lend itself, has to be flexible enough to allow you to do those things that are necessary to save the system. So on. All right. The subject is the hatred of the brothers to Yosef.
the hatred of the brothers to Yosef, and their plot to destroy him. Are you all familiar with the basic story? Right, that there was a serious friction between Yosef and the brothers. Seems that Yaakov's favorite treatment of Yosef triggered it off. Then we have the story of the dreams. And then Yaakov sent them off to see how they were doing. And when they encountered him, when he found them, actually, so they planned to dispose of him, to kill him. All right, then there's a whole further development over there. Reuven first tries to save him, then Yehuda, and finally they wind up selling him as a slave, which is a serious thing in its own right, because that was tantamount to destroying him. Take a individual youth, right? Just imagine your own situation, to take him away from his father, from his family, and to sell him as a slave in a strange land. You know, in those days, it said any time, especially in those days, it wasn't like, you know, like today, you have someone can still look to you, there's concepts of rights, whatever it is, but to put him into a land of Egypt as a slave, tantamount to basically destroying him. So there's one question that really stands out, if you read this whole thing. I don't know, I mean, I think it's something that bothers you, but a lot of things bother you sometimes emotionally, but you never really voice it. I'm sure you heard this as a kid, you learned it many times, and it's possible that, see, when you learn Chumash in school, you know, a lot of the things in Chumash are complicated on these simple levels. You know, they don't fit. They don't seem to make sense according to your own standards of what's right and wrong. But, you know, you're sort of trained to brush over a lot of these things and don't focus on them. Right? Now, what would you say is the serious problem over here, yes? Yeah? In other words, the problem is, like, if you have a certain concept of who you're dealing with. Now, even if you're dealing with people on a very lowly level, it seems hard to accept. If you just read an ordinary novel, an ordinary story about brothers, and you do, the things that Yosef did doesn't seem to be that terrible, even on an ordinary level. Alright, so his father favored him. We encounter this all the time. Alright, so he just liked him for that. And then he had some dreams. And the next thing you know, they're killing him, and they almost killed him. He's barely escaping his life, but instead he winds up being sold as a slave. It would be hard to understand, even on an ordinary level. Ordinary people don't do this. What was the provocation? Because, you know, even among lowly people, there's dealing with your own family, your own brother, certain identification, certain sympathy. But the question becomes very, very serious when we posit that we're dealing with people that are on a very high level. That these weren't just ordinary people. But these were the shifteka, these were the progenitors of Klal Yisrael. Each one of them was included in the bracha. It wasn't as in previous cases, where Yishmael was excluded, and Esav was excluded, they were deemed unfit. But all of the children received the brachos of Yaakov. It means to say that, and that was part of the seal of Yaakov, right? If you'll be my God, and your name will be, right? Barachi says that you will, your name will be associated with me, and you won't find any soul in my children. But all of my children will be perfected. So how can people who are ostensibly at a very high level do a thing like this? I mean, they can sin, they're not angels. But when they sin, it's different than the ordinary person. I mean, how do they justify their own mind? Were they just going crazy? You know, they had this emotional thing and they just decided something they couldn't talk to her. There's no reason at all. That's the problem. That's the problem. What was the underlying motivation for what they wanted to do? Was it simply an emotional dislike due to these factors that had occurred? Envy or ordinary sibling rivalry? Or was it something deeper? Yes? I mean, that the dreams definitely played a role. But if they believe that the dreams were truly nevuah, this is a dilemma you're going to find yourself in. Either they accepted that the dreams were prophetic, so if that's the case, they should have submitted to the will of God. Right? Then they should have accepted it. Whether they like it or not, if you assume that they're great men, that's the essence of being a great person, that they submit to the will of God, whether they like it or not. On the other hand, if they held that it was not prophetic, then it's just his own mattering, his own fantasy. So what is the problem here? And what are they afraid of? What I want to point out is that the... first of all, I want to show you that they weren't, even though they were wrong, and it was a sin what they were doing, but in their own minds, they were operating in accordance with what they considered to be the right thing to do. In other words, they felt that it was justified, that their action was justified. They held it was justified, according to their understanding. It wasn't just an emotional thing. And I want to show you that the, if you look at the psukim carefully, you'll see that their attitude toward Joseph went through a process of development. Now, it's true that it began with the, they hated him. And the hatred was rooted in the fact, I explained this last Friday, the hatred was rooted in the fact that Yaakov favored him. And that's an emotion, and we had a question with that. Because if people are on a high level, then why, what right do they have to hate someone just because he's a favorite of the father? They have to accept that. Whether it's right for the father to demonstrate. And I went so far as to say that there was nothing wrong. It was a natural phenomenon that Yaakov had a closer relationship with Yosef because Yosef was on a higher level of Chachma, so it's only natural that it's going to be a different relationship. And you can't default a person to that. You can't be angry at a parent. If a parent has a certain closeness with one child, or if a Rebbe has a certain closeness with a Talmud due to the fact that that Talmud shares with him a certain level of Chachma that nobody else can, so then you have no right to be angry. And so automatically there's going to be a certain closeness. Because that's the greatest closeness is that which is based upon the sharing of Chachma. So what is it? Is it? I mean, that's envy. That's Los Achmod. That is the issue of Los Achmod. You're not allowed to be envious. Because that shows that you have a problem accepting the framework of reality. The framework of reality. And you have no claim on somebody else's emotions. You really have no inherent claim on somebody else's emotions. I mean, the Rebbe, because if someone is your Rebbe, you have a certain right, certain claims, in other words. Help me, even the Rambam says, you don't understand, even 100 times he has to review with you, I mean, to explain to you and so forth, that's legitimate. But you have no claim on his emotions to dictate that he should have a certain emotional relationship with you, that he doesn't have with anybody else, or that he shouldn't have certain feelings with somebody else. I mean, that's out of the realm of your right. Ah. But nevertheless, he said that Yaakov was wrong. Yaakov should have taken into consideration. I mean, you know, the reality is that people do have emotions. So if a Rebbe does have a favorite, or if a parent does have a favorite, it's wise to hide it from the children. And there we said Yaakov was in error. Now we said that when the brothers, their hatred of Yosef, true, was based upon the fact that Yaakov was the idea of his being the favorite. But in their own minds, they attributed that to a defect in Yosef. It wasn't just like children. Like, oh, he's your favorite, we don't like him. No, they recognized he had the emotion. But they attributed this to the Yosef's scheming. In other words, they didn't know the true reason why Yaakov favored him. And they thought it was because Yosef had schemed against them and had given a bad report about them. The Ziba. Now, at this stage of the game, it simply produced Lo Yachlu Davu Shalom. That's all. It wasn't a serious hatred that would lead to any harm. But they just held he was a low level guy. They held he was on a low level, and they didn't want anything to do with him. But we see that the hatred went through a process of development. Now, where's the first change in the hatred? And let's see if you can define that change. So it says, this is Vayachlom Yosef Chalom, and Yosef dreamed the dream. Vayare Liachav, and he told it to his brothers. Vayosifu Otsnaoso. Vayosifu means there was an increase in their hatred. All right? Now, well, yeah, I know. Now, what was the nature of this increase? Because there's two kinds of increase. I mean, the increase could be a qualitative one or a quantitative one. And how does it fit in with the previous? What does this have to do with the previous thing, yes? Jeff. Yes. The thing is with this, the hatred underwent the change by Yosifu. Because beforehand, it was just a dislike of the person. So when you have a, when you dislike a person, when you dislike a person, I mean, everybody has to justify his feeling, right? If you, dislike, it's very rare that a person will say, I mean, I don't like this person. I recognize it's just a, an emotion. There's no reason. This person's a good person. That's a high level. That's a high, you know, then he said, the problem is me. I just have a certain emotion. I have to straighten that. That's a high level guy. But the average person, right, when he has a certain emotional attitude, he's seeking to justify it. He's looking for something that he can pin on the guy, right? Because if he dislikes him, must mean there's something wrong with that person, because his feelings are a true barometer. I mean, something wrong with the guy. So until this prevails, see, for me, the change occurs. And until now, it was just a dislike, because he's a low-level person. They held him as a low-level, immature kid. But now it underwent the change. It underwent a qualitative change. In other words, until now, they didn't realize that the extent of it. Here he's showing that he has egotistic ambition. That he's an egotist, that's one thing. There's two things over here that come at it. In other words, it's one thing to be immature and childish, to go snitching and bringing back a bad report. All right, just a low-level guy. But here they saw it's not so simple. This person is an egotist. He has these visions of grandeur. That's the dream. That's what they said. Hamoloch timloch aleinu. The moloch timloch means he wants to be the melech. He wants to be the melech. He has the ego to him. That's ego. And then they see that this guy's really a distorted personality. And it's one, as I'm saying, there's a difference. There's a difference in a person who simply is immature and doesn't have fixed on people, and one who has visions of grandeur. You're crazy. But that's not only that, you see, not only that, but he's also, his ambitions affect us. Marshall Timshol Bono. He wants to subjugate us. See? That's different than Moloch Timloch. In other words, Moloch Timloch is one thing. That's one, that means to say that you have this desire, this for your ego to be the ruler. Okay, that shows maybe a defect to you, but it doesn't bother me so much. So you want to be the king, so be the king. That's one type. You have an idiot in the world. I mean, there are certain cases where it's just a figurehead, like in England, the king of England. It has no power. There's a rule over anybody. There's no rule, but there's a halal of king. There's a title of king. You'll tell me, so what good is it if you can't? Well, the answer is there's plenty of people. Well, you see the whole, when the prince or the lady die and they got the wedding and everything, the whole world is watching every move they made. Why? I mean, these people have absolutely no consequence. Because it's the prince, because it's the king. Now, kings, and there's that tremendous fascination with a king and a prince and a princess. The whole business. These people have no power. The answer is that that's something. It's a title. It's a certain mark of distinction. So that's the first thing. Moloch Timloch, he has a desire to be the king. That's one. But that's the next one, that's a rebuke. That's a rebuke because you're an egotist. That shows you what kind of a person you are. But Marshal Timshol Aleinu is even worse. You're not satisfied just with the egotistic satisfaction of being king. Your desires are such that they have to express themselves in a need to rule over us. That's a difference. I mean, many people out there that wouldn't be satisfied. They have to actually be in command over others. They enjoy the fact that they control the lives of others. The power, the wielding of power. That's Marshal Timshol. That is even worse. That's even worse. You see? Because that's a further involvement in the emotional. But now that, it makes it mean that you really are an enemy to our enemy. That's the increase. In other words, now it's not just that you're a low-level person, but you are a danger and a threat to us. That's the first significant change. That's what you see, but it's a qualitatively different phenomenon. See? But I would say that even at this stage of the game, had it stopped at this, see, the Torah goes on. Why does the Torah have to tell you these things anyway? Why are they so important for us to know? The Torah goes on. Because I say that in this whole parasha over here is trying to prepare us to understand what the brother subsequently did. If it would have stopped over here, then they never would have killed him. That's my contention. They would have hated him. Because they would have regarded him as an egomaniac. But they wouldn't have had to destroy him. This is Vayomu. Let's take a look at the passage. Vayomu, Rechav, Amalok, Timloch, Aleinu. in Mashal Timshal Banu, would you rule over us by your Sifro Tznoso? And they hated him more. Al Chalamoto Fi Al Dvarav, on his dreams and on his Dvarav, on his words. What Dvarav is it referring to? What words is it referring to? What? Now Rashi says that his Dvarav refers to what? His Dibas Rav. The Al Dvarav, Al Dibasam Rav, Shayimedi Raviyam. Now that's a little bit strange, isn't it? Because why at this point did they hate him for the diva ra that he brought? I mean, he should have hated him before. But the diva, they didn't find out about the diva now. The diva occurred before. Then you had the dream, right? So as a result of the dreams, they hated him for the dreams and for the diva ra. That doesn't make any sense, yes? That's part of the Yosifu. You know, they hated him originally for the diva, as he said. The first hatred of him was due to the Ziba, because they thought that that's why Yaakov favored him. But this was a reinterpretation of the Ziba. At first they thought the Ziba was completely harmless. They didn't realize it was part of the grand design. See? In other words, yeah, they had a whole new insight into him. So they looked back upon him. In other words, once they had these dreams and they saw what kind of a character he is, so now they looked back on all of his behavior and they reinterpreted his behavior. So by Yosefo, they now the diva wasn't just the innocent, prank of an immature kid, but that's part of his whole design to seize power and to be a ruler over us. You see? What do you want to say? That the pasuk describes it, it says Vayachlam Yosef Chalom Vayagid Liyachav, and he told his brothers. Now, what did he tell his brothers? He didn't tell them the dream yet. Because then it says later on he told him the dream. Because then it says Vayom Aleim Shimunu Achalam Azeh Shechalamti Vina Anachem. He tells him the dream. So what does it mean in Pasuk Hey Vayachalam Yosef Chalam Vayaged Liyachav? And he told it to his brothers. It means what? He told his brothers that he had a dream. Vayaged, they told him a dream, and the hatred increased. Then after they heard the dream, it says Vayosifu Otsno Osav Al Chalam Osav Yal Dvarav. So even in that phase, there was two changes. From the mere fact that he told them that he had a dream, this already caused an increase. Because when he told them he had a dream, he meant a significant dream. But that already, that shows another level in this person. He considers himself to be a one who has these significant prophetic dreams. I mean, that's a tremendous, like a tremendous egotism, like a person who's making these claims. Like he has dreams that we should all listen to. So that already caused an increase in the hatred. But that wasn't the when they actually heard the content of the dream, because it's different. In other words, like this, as soon as he told them that he had these dreams, they already knew that this guy's an egomaniac. That's what he was telling us in dreams, right? He obviously considers himself to be an exalted person who dreams portend the future events. But that's one thing. It's one thing, in other words, if you know that a person, has these fantasies about himself. When you actually have the content of the fantasy, it makes a change. See, it's one thing if you suspect. One thing is to suspect that this person harbors these desires. But, you can't be 100% sure. When they heard the dreams, then the hatred increased even more. But now it's a different phenomenon. Now that we got him as the enemy. Yes? Yeah, the interesting question would be, why did Yosef tell these dreams to his brothers? Why did Yosef tell the dream to his brothers? And he tells Joseph, yeah. Not only that, another question could be raised is, why did Yaakov ever send Yosef out alone and put him in such a situation of danger? And why did Yosef go? Even if his father, you're not mechuyev to listen to your father when your father tells you to put your life in danger. Right? I would say that basically, as we'll see, that this fits into what we said, the pattern that Yosef was basically immature and naive in this respect, politically. And his debug, the fact that he brought back a bad report, was not motivated by baseness. He was really concerned with the brothers, and he held that they should be rebuked. But we said that his defect was his inability to identify with them. He had no patience. He had no patience for their defect. But he was very naive, you see? And since he was naive, if he was really that crafty, he wouldn't have told the brothers. But it all stemmed from the fact that he was naive. He didn't, he was immature politically. He didn't understand what was going on. So he was very, he thought they would be very happy to hear the divorce. He thought he was doing something, you know, he was sharing a divorce. And he himself, by the way, after yours, when he had this divorce, he wasn't thrilled that he's going to be the leader. I mean, he wasn't on that level. He was on a high level. So he simply wanted to share with them the knowledge of the Ashkacha, what was going to happen. But not to lord it over them. He was totally in a completely different wavelength. And that's why that's all wrong. You see. Now, you know, Yosef desired to share the dreams. In his own mind, he did not understand the emotion of the brothers. He thought they'd be very happy to hear it. That shows you that he was really naive. And that shows that he himself didn't have an egotist. If he was a real egotist in that sense, then he would have sensed that other people are not going to like to hear this. He would have kept it hidden. But the fact of the matter is, he didn't view it that way. Now, the next step. Then it says, Vayakvah Chalom Acher. He dreamt another dream. Vayasafer Oso Liyakov. And he told it to his brother. So you see, he didn't learn from their reaction. They rebuked him in this case. So the question, of course, is, why did he have to... All right, the first time he was naive. What was the statement? The first time you could attribute it to his... to his naivete. But this time he should have learned it. But nevertheless, he proceeds. Bayomri says, Hine chalamti chalomod. He says, behold, I've dreamed another dream. Hine Hashemesh vayareah. He says, and the sun and the moon, the 11 stars, mishtachmimli, are bound to me. So it seems to be the same, pretty similar type of dream. The dream seems to be following a basic pattern. Same thing. You don't have to be a great psychoanalyst, right, to see my basic idea. In one case, it's bundles are bowing down to him. In this case, it's sun and moon and the stars are bowing down to him. But the basic idea seems to come through. In fact, you don't have to. It doesn't require too much interpretation.
How did
the bowl bow down? Now that's it. That's not fair, and he told it to his father, the Alecha. And his brothers, which means to say, according to the Mepharshim, that he told it over twice. The first time he told it just to his brother. Just to his brother. Then he brought his father in. And the question, of course, is why? Why did he... The first thing he didn't tell to his father. He told to the brothers. And the second dream, the second dream he told to his brothers first, then he repeated it over in the presence of his father a second time. By Yigal Balavim, then his father rebuked him. By Yomalo, and said to him, Machalom was Esha Chalomta. What does this mean that you dream? Avon Nevo Ani V'Yimchal Yachera? Shall I, he recognized what it implies, shall I and your mother and your brothers come, L'shachmos L'cha Arsa, to bow down on the ground to you? So Yaakov dismissed the whole thing. By Yitana Bo'echav, and his brothers were jealous of him. The Aviv Shomer Asadava, and his father guarded the matter. What does it mean his father guarded the matter? Of Shomer Asadava. Right, so Rashi says, by a mamsin and mitzafen mosayava. He waited and was looking forward, actually, mitzafen. Because mitzafen means not just to wait, but to actually anticipate, to look forward. That's what the Rambam says. It's the mitzvah by the Shia. Be mamin, to believe in the phenomenon, right? And mitzafen l'biyato. And to be in a state of waiting for its coming. Wait. Expectation. So, you see that Yaakov apparently believed it was true. So why did he rebuke it? That's one question. But the other question is, if you notice, there was two different reactions. In the first dream, it says that they hated him. By Yisifu Otsno, so it was hatred. Al Chalamosa V'Aldvaro. The result of the second dream was by Yitanabo Echad, Kina, jealousy. The question is, why the Torah doesn't just, use terms arbitrarily. Why did this dream produce the result of envy, jealousy? And the first one merely produced the result of hatred. What was different about this one? Both of the dreams signify the idea of power, of ruling over the brothers. But there is a difference between the two. It's not by accident that these first dream expressed itself through the bundle, and the second one expressed itself by the sun and the moon and the stars. It's a different connotation. I mean, it's not just simply arbitrary that God chose, that the first dream he chose the idea in one form, and the second dream, it's not just a repetition of the same idea in two different forms. Where do you find the repetition of the same idea in two different forms? In the case of the dream of Pharaoh. In the case of the dream of Pharaoh. That the that was the key how Yosef was able to interpret certain things about Pharaoh from that dream. So he says the two dreams and the repetition, why does it repeat itself? First it was in seven. In other words, the idea that the seven good years followed and consumed by seven lean years was expressed in two forms. One through the cows, the fat cows and the skinny cows, right? Then the seven stalks. The good stalks, right? Consumed by the seven lean and beaten stalks. Right? Now in that case, it's the identical the identical thing, just repeated in a different form. But that's not, and that's what Yosef said. And why the Ali Shana Sachalom and the repetition of the dream is to make the point that Nachon Hadava Meisha Olokim Olamayar Olokim Lasosa. That's to convey the idea that it's going to come back soon. That's the idea of repetition. I mean, there's a whole code. How to interpret the repetition of the dream implies that it's coming back quickly. And so, in other words, you got to. It's urgent. It's not something in the distant future. But in this case, it's not identical. It's two different dreams. Now. To explain this, I want to bring up another issue, which Rabbi Chait explained. I'm going to borrow an idea from Rabbi Chait over here. If you take a look at the case, you see after Yosef becomes the ruler, right? And then you have the years of plenty, and they store up all the food. Then it's followed by the years of famine, right? So, in Perek Membeis, Pasuk Vav, says the brothers came down to get food, because there was a famine in Canaan. The Yosef Hashal, the Lord Zuma Mashdur, Chalam Arat, Yosef was the ruler. He's the one that was in charge of the food, distribution of food. So that gave him enormous power over the whole world. And the brothers came back at him. Then it says that Yosef was his brothers and he recognized them. And he acted strange. And he acted like a stranger, like he didn't know them. And he spoke harshly to them. And he asked them, where do you come from? And they said, from the land of Canaan to get food. Then it says that Yosef recognized his brothers and they didn't recognize him. Then it says, Vayifka Yosef is a chaloma, the choma. But Yosef remembered the dreams that he had dreamed concerning them. Vayoma alayim, and he said to them, Aragla matem, you are spies. You come to spy out the vulnerability, the nakedness, literally, of the land. So I tell you, ask the question, which should be on everybody's mind here, what's the connection? He then, the accusation is, what is the connection? He remembered the dreams and he accused them of being spies. What's one thing have to do with the other? What does one thing have to do with the other? And then he launches into his plan. The plan, whatever the plan entailed of making them think that they were and in danger with him and taking a hostage and that, the whole thing that he puts them through, he launches into that. But that's preceded by the introduction of remembering the dream. So I can't explain like this, that everything that Yosef did to the brothers, he subjected them to all this pain, he took away Shimon, he locked them up, and he put them through this tremendous torture. Getting them to think that they were in danger and they would be locked up and they could lose everything. And, you know, then it would be hiding in the cups and Binyamin, all the stuff that he did to them. Why did he do it? What was his purpose in this? I mean, was it simply for the sake of revenge? No. It was all done. No, it couldn't have been for the sake of revenge. You see, he didn't harbor any vengeful feelings. You see, in the course of carrying it out, the Torah always, when he spoke to them, he saw the pain they were going through, he had to leave the room and cry. And then he came back. So the Torah is pointing out to you that he didn't want to do this because of his own emotions. But everything he did was for the sake of what? You see that as a result of this, they did a tshuva gemura. Avol Hashem Manasseh, it says immediately afterwards, when this happened, they started to analyze. They knew that things didn't just happen by accident. They started to analyze what could they have done to warrant this treatment. Avol Hashem Manasseh. And they reviewed and they came back to a completely different understanding of, and at this stage of the game, they were ready to realize that they had erred completely in what they did to Yosef. They had done a terrible chet. And eventually, in the end, it led to Tshuva Gemura, because the Tshuva Gemura was with Yehuda. If Yehuda was prepared to give up his entire life and to be a prisoner of Yosef in order to bring back Benjamin back to his father. And Benjamin was really psychologically a substitute for Yosef in the psyche of Yaakov. Here, Yaakov wouldn't part with Benjamin. So Yosef did all of this for Shem Shemayim. His purpose was to bring them to Jews. But then the question arises, does one, you know, do we have the right? How far can you go in intervening in somebody else's life, even for good things? With the kind of things that he did, would I have the right to do that? Do you have the right to do that?